So I'm sticking with my schedule because I had a very spelled out schedule for this study. After today, we finish up next week. We got chapter 14 today, an amazing chapter. So much content in that chapter. And then in chapter 15 next week, which is amazing, Rabidash the Ridiculous. Next week, to kind of whet your appetite, we can talk about Nebuchadnezzar. We can talk about the book of Daniel. That chapter about Rabidash the Ridiculous is very memorable. A lot of biblical allusions. You know, maybe of all the Chronicles, I'm getting convinced this one has the largest number of biblical allusions to them. And when you get to heaven, ask Jack if we were right about that. This book does, and this chapter just about does. But, you know, compare this to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or Prince Caspian. This just has an abundance, and you'll see it again in chapter 14, because when I say there's a great deal of content here, a lot of it, there's a lot going on in this chapter, and it's amazing biblical allusions. Some are beyond allusions. Some of them, like, they're not allusions. They slap you in the face, such as when Aslan says to Bree, "Touch me. I'm not a spirit or a metaphor. If you don't see John chapter 20, Thomas, you know, that's what Jesus says to Thomas, touch me, and proves he's real. Anyway, so some of them are not even allusions. They're not direct references because, you know, Jack doesn't say, i.e. John chapter 20. So they're allusions. You kind of have to pick up on what he's putting down. Anyway, so chapter 14. Notice the chapter title. How Bree Became a Wiser Horse. How Bree Became a Wiser Horse. I hope you define wisdom as God does, as C.S. Lewis is getting ready to illustrate for you. I don't know how you define wisdom. The world will help you define wisdom. The world doesn't know a lot about wisdom. The world knows more about information. But if the world may try to define wisdom for you. So make sure you don't miss the whole forest because you're looking at individual trees. How Bree Became a Wiser Horse. We'll get to it, but how did he become a wiser horse? What did he become? What Christian attribute? Humble, thank you. Now see, in this culture, becoming a wiser horse meant how to make a whole lot of money without working very hard. I mean, that's this culture. But notice what wisdom means. And that's very core Christianity. How Bree became a wiser horse. Anyway, look at the chapter. There's a couple of parts of it we'll look at pretty closely and make some connections. So the Battle of Anvard has happened. That's where Shasta is. He's learned that he's Kor, you know, son of the king, twin to Korin. But now we're back at the hermitage. We're back at the home of the hermit of the Southern March. So we're back there now. So that means you got the hermit, and you've got three of them. You've got Wynn and Erebus, and you've got Bree, called Shasta, who is going to show up at the end of the chapter. Shasta's still in Anvard, learning he's the son of the king. Anyway, so here they wake up, or here they're having a conversation. They realize you got the pool that you're looking at, and the hermit can't hear, but he can see, and he sees that Shasta's okay. He's not dead. He's not seriously wounded. The battle's over. So, of course, that makes Erebus and Wynn and Bree, the lady and the two horses, happy. So they go to bed. They wake up the next morning, and you got this amazing conversation between the three. And the hermit's inside. Well, Erebus is outside, starts out with Erebus and Bree, and then eventually Erebus shows up. You know, Wynn is all excited to get to Narnia. Let's go to Narnia. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go. What's Bree's reaction? Well, do we need to go today? Maybe not today. What's your hurry? And then Aravis shows up. And Aravis says, well, we do need to get with Shasta. And notice, watch the transformations. Aravis says, we do need to connect back up with Shasta. And I need to apologize to him. And of course, Bree's like, yeah, yes, 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 whatever. Yeah, we got more things to do. We cannot leave now going to Narnia. He just doesn't want to go to Narnia, and you find out why. He doesn't really want to go to Narnia. And actually, you notice here at the beginning, even Aravis says, I suppose so. She has begun to wonder what exactly she would do when she got there and was feeling a little bit lonely, feeling a little lonely. So even Aravis, now that they've been passionate about going to Narnia, even Aravis is like, what's my new life going to be like? I'm not going to be royalty. I'm not going to be a Tarkina. Not sure what I'll be in Narnia. So she's getting some concerns about her new world. You know, it's kind of like everybody wants to go to heaven, just not right now. I hope you're excited about the new world. And again, I notice most Christians aren't, because if one more person tells me when I wish them happy birthday, if they tell me was better than the alternative, I'm going to say, no, it ain't. I mean, that's just a cultural thing for us. We kind of, you know, if we can't get this world, well, I guess we'll take heaven. You know, and you notice, and we'll get to it, at the end of the story, here's old Bree going like he's going to a funeral. He's going to Narnia. He's going to the realm of Aslan. Anyway, so they're having this conversation, and you know, Bree just wants to not go. And what's the issue for Bree that Wen finally figures out, and not only does she figure out it's maybe one of the prevailing issues, she actually figures it out with a horse laugh on the bottom of page 198. What she figures out is the issue with Bree. His tail has been cropped. And I'm not much of a farmer. I grew up in a mill village that my grandparents had farms out in the county. None of them had horses. I had to go it's amazing. Just Google, why do horses have their tails cropped? Or docked, he says docked. Why do you dock a tail of a horse? See, ask the question, why do you dock a tail of a horse? That means you dock a tail of a horse because if that horse is like leading wagons and carriages and plows, you don't want the tail to get tangled in the equipment. So that docked tail says to the world, I'm a workhorse. Now, Bree's very proud. He's not really, but you know, he had to get disguised to go through Teshbon. So he had his tail cropped to look like a plain run-of-the-mill non-talking, non-Narnian, non-war horse, just a workhorse. So he's had his tail cropped. And he's, you know, so he's wondering how he's going to be treated by the real talking Narnian horses. So look down at the bottom. Wen broke into a horse laugh. This is the bottom of the second page of my edition on page 198. Wen broke out into a horse laugh. It's your tail, Bree. I see it all now. You want to wait till your tail's grown again. And we don't even know if tails are worn long in Narnia. Really, Bree, you're as vain as the Tarkina, as that Tarkina, that particular Tarkina in Teshbon. Who's he talking about? Who's the vain Tarkina? Lacerlene, yeah. So, we need to talk a little bit more about vanity in the Christian community. You know, Proverbs 31:30, you know, beauty, you know, because I just read it, it was requested when it gets requested. I read it at a funeral for a lady last week. The family asked for Proverbs 31, what the book of Proverbs lists as a virtuous woman paints the picture. And perhaps you remember hearing this. It's a rather long text. It is so long, I think some people start dozing off. But if you listen to the text, as the whole thing's read, what is read at a lot of females' funerals is Proverbs 31:10 through the end. It starts out, an excellent wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. But as you're reading along to the end, it says, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but the woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. You know, we don't talk much about modesty anymore in the Christian community. I think we can talk less about vanity. Now, I don't think you have to look so plain that you are horrifying to the people around you. My dad, who is one of the greatest, sweetest people on planet Earth, I never heard him talk about anybody. He never got it. But he was a World War II veteran. He did used to say, talking about Eleanor Roosevelt, I'd hate to wake up and have to look at that in the middle of the night. My dad would never say that about, but somehow Eleanor Roosevelt was fair game. Anyway, you know, we've gone to a far extreme now. We don't talk about modesty. We don't talk about vanity. You're not what you look like. Anyway, so Wynn's figured out he's being vain. He doesn't know what the world's going to be like there. And his tail is cropped or docked, as Jack says. And then he says, and we're going to get into this text, by the lion's mane, Tarquina, I'm nothing of that sort, said Bree indignantly. I have a proper respect for myself. We can rationalize anything. Even pure vanity, we can rationalize it. Well, so at that point, Ervis says to Bree, why do you say by the lion's mane? Why do you say by the lion? And again, he grew up. Bree was a horse from Narnia, so he grew up in Aslan's world. So he starts explaining why, and this is an amazing text, he starts explaining why he's referencing the lion almost as an affirmation. So I'm going to start reading where it says, so I do, answered Bree. He's saying why he refers to the lion. So I do, answered Bree, but when I speak of the lion, of course, I mean Aslan, the great deliverer of Narnia who drove away the witch in the winter. That's the lion, the witch, and wardrobe. All Narnians swear by him. But is he a lion? Again, you know, Erebus is from the south. She doesn't know all this stuff. Is he a lion? Now, here comes the liberal Christian theologian who Jack was fighting every day of the week when he was teaching at Oxford. Oh, no, of course he's not a lion, said Bree in a rather shocked voice. All the stories about him in Tashbon say he is, says Erebus. And if he isn't a lion, why do you call him a lion? Well, you hardly understand that at your age, says Bree. And I was only a little foal when I left, so I don't quite understand it myself. Bree was standing with his back to the green wall. Get this image. He's standing with his back to the wall. He's in the hermit's compound. Bree was standing with his back to the wall while he said this, and the other two were facing him. They could see the wall. Facing him, he was talking in a rather superior tone. Notice how Bree is getting transformed. He's talking in a superior tone with his eyes half shut. Right? Jack is just thinking of some of the scholars he's working with at Oxford. He's talking in a superior tone with his eyes half shut. That was why he didn't see the change expressions in the faces of Wynn and Erebus. Their expressions change. They see something on the wall behind Bree. They had good reason to have open mouths and staring eyes, because while Bree spoke, see the love of Aslan, see the gentleness of Aslan here. So as Bree spoke, they saw an enormous lion jump up from outside and balance itself on the top of the green wall. So Aslan's up there. Here's Bree sounding like an academic theologian. He's not a real lion. He's a metaphor. He's not a real lion. And Aslan gets to hear some of this. So that, you know, they see this enormous lion jump up. Only it was a brighter yellow, and it was bigger and more beautiful and more alarming than any lion they'd ever seen. And at once it jumped down inside the wall behind Bree, and he's approaching Bree from behind. It made no noise at all. Remember, this book is a great deal about the hiddenness of God. So, I mean, here's Aslan walking up behind Bree. And when and Aravis couldn't make any noise themselves, no more than as if they were frozen. So Bree doesn't see it. They're watching Aslan come up behind. I mean, Bree doesn't see it, but when and Aravis sees Aslan coming up. And Aslan's letting Bree continue. No doubt, continued Bree, when they speak of him as a lion, they only mean he's as strong as a lion. Or to our enemies, of course, as fierce as a lion or something of that kind. Even a little girl like you, Aravis, now that's called mansplaining, if you haven't heard that. Even a little girl like you, Aravis, must see that it would be quite absurd to suppose he is a real lion. Indeed, it would be disrespectful. Aslan's standing there. Listen to this. Indeed, it would be disrespectful if he was a lion. He'd have to be a beast like the rest of us. Why? And here Bree began to laugh. If he was a lion, he'd have four paws and a tail and whiskers. And I don't know how to make this sound of a horse getting excited. Anyway, the horse gets excited. For just as he said the word whiskers, now, don't mean to sound a little sacrilegious. If I'd have been Aslan, I'd have bopped Bree upside the head. But just as he said the word whiskers, one of Aslan's actually tickled Bree's ear. Bree shot away like an arrow to the other side of the enclosure, and there turned. The wall was too high for him to jump, and he could not go any further. Aravis and Wynn both started back. There was about a second of intense silence. Then Wynn, though shaking all over, gave a strange little neigh and trotted across to the line. I love this. This is Wynn. Trotted across to the line. Please, she, Wynn, said, you're so beautiful. You may eat me if you like. I'd sooner be eaten by you than fed by anyone else. If anyone would follow me, he's got to deny himself, pick up his cross, and follow after me daily. You've got to be crucified to self. You've got to die to self. This preaches, you may eat me if you like. I'd rather be eaten by you than fed by anyone else. Baptism is a sign of dying and being buried with Christ to be raised to new life. Yeah. Are you willing to let Aslan devour you? Or you just want him to have a little bit of your life? Dearest daughter, said Aslan, planting a lion's kiss on her twitching velvet nose, I knew you would not be long in coming to me. Joy shall be yours. Books and books and books have been written about C.S. Lewis and what he means by joy. His autobiography is surprised by joy. You know, and anyway, would love to get into all that, but what C.S. Lewis means by joy, that experience, well, you sing it. Blessed assurance, Jesus is mine. Oh, what a foretaste of joy divine, glory divine. I mean, we think joy is, you know, going to Busch Gardens and riding a roller coaster. Nothing against those. My kids love those. But joy for Jack was a foretaste of the divine, a foretaste of heaven, you know, a taste of another world that tells you you belong to that world, not this world. So joy, particularly, joy and desiring the right thing, wanting the right thing, is very tied together for C.S. Lewis. So, yeah, and as a matter of fact, joy shall be yours. This is Wynn, who's been more gentle, humble, kind. This is Wynn. But he is going to turn his attention to Bree. Then he lifted his head and he spoke in a louder voice. Now, Bree, he said, you poor, proud, frightened horse, draw near me. Nearer still, my son, do not dare not to dare. Touch me, smell me. John 20, Thomas. Here are my paws. This is exactly what Jesus said. Here are my hands. Here's my side. Touch me. Smell me. Here are my paws. Here's my tail. These are my whiskers. I am a beast. Now, what Jack is confronting here, I'm going to give you a... You're smart people, so you don't let your eyes glaze over. I'm going to introduce you to an ancient heresy that's alive and well in the Christian church. We condemned it in the 4th century, but some of you didn't get the memo. We condemned the 4th century, and Jack knew it well. He actually, in 1944, he wrote the preface, or introduction preface, to a new translation of Athanasius, as one of our early church fathers, Athanasius's treatise called On the Incarnation. On the Incarnation, Incarnation of Jesus, On the Incarnation. Jack actually wrote a preface to that, which, by the way, is an amazing preface. He doesn't say much about Athanasius or the book, but actually the preface they wrote in 1944, and you'll see why I want to recommend this to you. It actually got later published as a standalone essay. The title of the standalone essay, or the preface to On the Incarnation by Athanasius, is On the Reading of Old Books. Yeah, a lot of our culture needs that. Why, you know, I think he says for every 2 books you read, make sure you read 1 old book, like Athanasius from the 4th century. On the Incarnation, to make sure you're not so captured by the age in which you're living. Read an old book. You know, he did say that in the preface to On the Incarnation by Athanasius. Now, so let's think about the Incarnation a minute. Jesus, well, let me give you the heresy, because then that'll help you know what the biblical faith is. There were Christians running around in the first couple centuries who had such a high view of God. Such a high view of God. They could not fathom that God would take our fallen human flesh, come down, have to eat, have to sleep, have to go to the Port of John. They just couldn't have to die, have to suffer, have to die. So they had their high view of God, their high view of the spiritual world. And their high view of God was such, it wasn't a real incarnation. He just seemed human. They would even say when they would read the Gospels, we declare this heresy. When they'd read the Gospels, when Jesus said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, that's when the Christ spirit left Jesus. Because God can't die. God can't suffer. God doesn't need to take potty breaks. God doesn't need to take a nap in the back of the boat. So as in the early Christian community, there were Christians. We called them, here's your fancy term. If you win money on Jeopardy, church gets parts of it. They were called, the heresy is docetism. They were called docetists. It comes from the Greek word dokeo, which means he only seemed human. Well, go read Athanasius, 4th Church Father, who said it was a real incarnation. He's not, and that's why, by the way, I always ruin, and I don't mean to, well, I guess I do mean to. I've done every church. I ruin Away in a Manger for churches. Because it's a docetic hymn. You know, Away in a Manger, blah, 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 blah. And some people just call it Luther's cradle hymn. Everybody figured out Luther was no heretic. He didn't write that thing. No crying he makes. We can't even let the baby Jesus cry. That's docetic. Now, you know, when people get bent out of shape about maybe a concept that Jesus married, they're 100% right. There's no evidence he married. There's strong evidence he did not. You know, and we're still paying a price for that. If he'd have married and been normal, it made our life easier for the last 2,000 years. Lots of high evidence he did not marry. He could have. Because he without sin, he entered fully into the human experience. It really is an incarnation. Go back and watch Most of you know the King of Kings 1961 version with Jeffrey Hunter. That was real popular when I was young and had an important part of my King of Kings, you know, is the story of Jesus. But that movie was first released like in 1927. Obviously, it's a black and white silent movie. Go, you can pull it off YouTube, I'm sure. Sometimes Turner Classic runs those silent movies in the middle of the night. Go look at the 1927 King of Kings. Jesus glows like that person on Touched by an Angel. He glows. You expect to see him floating over the ground. He is so docetic. Now, the people in 1927 were doing it out of respect. They gave him a halo as he walked around. Well, if that would have been true, every Jew would have accepted him. Everybody in his culture would accept. He was very human. He appeared as human, which is why when he tried to say to the world, oh, by the way, I'm the Father, our one. I'm the Messiah and I'm divine. Well, no. God doesn't do messy, vulgar things like get involved in our matter and have a body. That's core Christianity. That's core Christianity. You know, he was, you know, it's bad math, but he's 100% human, 100% divine. Human beings, and we do it, we've been doing it for 2,000 years. Some people hang out on the 100% divine. Some people hang out on the 100% human. Very, very, very conservative Christians, they make him more divine than he was. Very, very liberal, progressive Christians make him more human than he was. He's 100% both. That's why you, in our sanctuary, that's why you have two sets of candles. This is true for most sanctuaries. That's why you've got two sets of candles in worship space. One for the humanity of Jesus, one for the divinity of Jesus. It's 100%. Now, again, bad math. You can't be 100%, but you ought to be 50-50. But if you think he's 50-50, you're docetic. He was 100% divine. Jack knew how to do theology. He wrote the preface on the incarnation, which is what Athanasius wrote in the 4th century. Now, I do repent of the fact that we started probably burning Docetists. I'm glad we don't burn you Docetists now that hang around in the body of Christ. But, you know, we made our decision firmly in the 4th and 5th century. He's 100% human. So, don't say this to your grandchild when you're reading this text. But here, touch me, smell me. Here are my paws. Here's my tail. I am a true beast. In the Christian tradition, I am a human being. I really was. I'm God incarnate, not God seeming to be like a human to pull the wool over our eyes. That's why when you sing the hymn, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, and you say, the day our mighty Maker died, our mighty Maker died, be shocked, be rocked by what we are affirming that God did for us. When you say He came down to our level, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word took flesh, and He tabernacled among us. This is basic Christianity. So you're preparing your grandchildren and your children to understand basic Christianity. So no. If I have anything to do with it, you do not sing Away in a Manger here. It's docetic. It's cute. It's sweet. It's sentimental. No crying He makes. My babies cry. Your babies cry. Don't make it. Don't create a Jesus that's so divine that He's completely removed from Scripture. I hate I just ruined that hymn for you. But do it. Just please don't attribute it to Martin Luther. Martin Luther knew better. Anyway, so this is some heavy-duty theology going on here. Watch this. As Aslan said, Bree, in a shaken voice, I'm afraid I must be rather a fool. Now, if you know the book of Job, this is exactly what happened to Job. Job and his friends theologized up to chapter 38 in that book, and God shows up, you know, says to Job, were you here when I created the world? Were you here when I laid the foundations of the globe? Were you here when I created the oceans? Were you here? You must have been there advising me, Job, and I didn't realize it when I created everything. And you remember what Job, the change in Job at the end is he's humbled and he has a new vision of God. That's what Bree's getting here. He's humbled. And of course, he's becoming humble. I brought something to read you. Of course, one of the greatest books of all time is Mere Christianity. You know, you don't have to like every word he writes or understand every word he writes, even like every chapter. Just like the chapters you like and read them frequently. But, for instance, in book three, because this originally came out in four. These are radio talks that got put in print. Then they were originally printed in four different books. And then finally, publisher said, hey, we'll just put all four together because they don't make a long book even though they're all four together. But in book three, chapter eight, you've got a chapter that has led, I think this is the chapter that grabbed a hold of Charles Colson. You know, this book, there's a biography of this book available now by Rich, his last name's Marsden. I should remember him. He was at Duke, and I don't remember. Anyway, Dr. Marsden. There's a book by Marsden. It's part of a series, which I'm excited about. I wish it had produced more biographies of great books. It's a book about a book. So there's a biography of Mere Christianity. And in there, you learn wonderful stuff like how many people came to Christ through this book, how many people were discipled because of this book. But it's book three, chapter eight, is the one, if you don't read but one chapter, oh gosh, it's hard to say. Let me give you five chapters. I will allow you five chapters to read out of Mere. But if you only can read one, for whatever reason, Book 3, chapter 8. It's called The Great Sin. Now, before you read, you think, what is the greatest of all sins? Let me just read you a couple of passages. After he introduces his topic, he says stuff like, the vice I am talking of is pride or self-conceit. And the virtue opposite to it in Christian morality is called humility. He's speaking what we've said for 2,000 years. Go back and read Augustine, Athanasius. The vice I'm talking about is pride or self-conceit, and the virtue opposite of it in Christian morals is called humility. Now watch this. He's writing this at night. He's speaking this in the 40s. You may remember when I was talking about sexual morality, I warned you that the center of Christian morals did not lie there. Now if you look at pop culture today, that's all Christians want to talk about. And it needs to be talked about. It needs to be discussed. But he's exactly right. If you're a Christian and you want to look at what's really important, what's the greatest of all sin, well, we know what we Christians do. The greatest of all sins are the sins you commit and I don't. So I'm going to talk about gambling. So he says here, the vice I'm talking about is pride or self-conceit, the opposite is humility. You may remember in this book, when I was talking about sexual morality, and he says a lot about it, I warned you that the center of Christian morality does not lie there. Well, now you have come to the center. According to the Christian teachers, the essential vice, the utmost evil, is pride. Unchastity, and he's going to tell you why. Unchastity, anger, greed, drunkenness, and all that are mere flea bites in comparison. It was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride, watch this, pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. Yeah, this got a hold of Chuck Colson. Because Chuck had been, some of you may be too young to know Chuck Colson. He went down under Watergate. He was in the circle of power, one of the key henchmen, advisors for President Nixon, who while he was in jail came to Christ. My mentor for my doctoral dissertation, Dr. Richard Lovelace, was the person that Charles Colson, went to be discipled in Christ. When Chuck realized, I grew up in this culture, but I know nothing about this Christianity, but this got a hold of him. Pride, it was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. A little bit more. It is pride which has been the chief cause of every misery in every nation and every family since the world began. Other vices may sometime bring people together. Listen to this. Hear what he's saying. Other vices may sometimes bring people together. You may find good fellowship and jokes and friendliness among drunken people or unchaste people, but pride always means enmity. It is enmity, And not only enmity between man and man, but enmity to God. A little bit more. It is a terrible thing that the worst of all the vices can smuggle itself. That's what makes it so bad. It is terrible that the worst of all vices can smuggle itself into the very center of our religious life. Now, nobody's going to make drunkenness or sexual immorality, I hope, the center of their Christian life. But pride can smuggle itself right into that center. But you can see why. The other and less bad vices come from the devil working on us through our animal nature. But this does not come through, this pride thing, does not come through our animal nature at all. It comes direct from hell. It is purely spiritual. Consequently, it is far more subtle and deadly. For the same reason, pride can often be used to beat down the simpler vices. Teachers, in fact, often appeal to a boy's pride, or as they call it, his self-respect. Remember what he had? Yeah, same person wrote this stuff. Or often refer to their self-respect to make him behave decently. Many a man has overcome cowardice or lust or ill temper by learning to think that they are beneath his dignity. That is my pride. The devil laughs. He is perfectly content to see you becoming chaste and brave and self-controlled. All the time, he is setting you up in the... He is setting you up in the dictatorship of pride. Just as he would be quite content to see your chilblains, I don't know what that is, I need to look that one up. He'd be quite content to see your chilblains cured, if he were allowed in return, I should look that one up, to give you cancer. For pride is spiritual cancer. It eats up the very possibility of love or contentment or even common sense. And again, we'll take pride and we'll morph it into religious virtue. We don't do that with drunkenness. We don't do that with sexual morality. And again, it was pride. So, we could talk about pride for a whole fall or spring. You need to make sure you have a proper relationship to pride. Or Aslan might come and do to you what he's doing to Bree. I mean, this is the transformation happening in Bree. Anyway, we've got to move on. But yeah, pay attention to pride. Again, sexual immorality and drunkenness is not as subtle as pride is. If you read Screwtape Letters, the enemy knows how to come after us. And it's always the good things, the things that can be good, the things that can masquerade as good that the enemy uses to pull us away from Christ. Anyway. Okay, so it continues here. So yeah, Aslan said Bree in a shaken voice, "I'm afraid I must be rather a fool." Okay, keep watching the transformation. Happy the horse who knows that while he is still young, or the human either. Now humility, make sure you hear this. Humility, now again, it's not really C.S. Lewis, it's sort of C.S. Lewis, but the quote comes directly from Rick Warren, Purpose-Driven Life. Humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. Jack almost said that, but that comes straight from Warren, and it's true. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. Oh, I'm such a poor, horrible creature. I have no gifts. I can't accomplish anything for anybody. You know, poor, pitiful me. I'm Eeyore. That's not humility. Humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. The whole world doesn't have to revolve around me, what I want. And so, in other words, what humility is in Christianity, and to C.S. Lewis, is not self-abasement. You know, I don't have to flagellate myself. It is a clear-headed self-evaluation. It is a clear-eyed awareness of who I am. Yeah, I'm not God. Don't want that job. I'm not Lord. I don't want that job either. I'm not even going to be your God or your Lord and try to run your life. So, you know, we need to make sure we know what pride is, make sure we know what humility is to make sure, I hesitate, but there are Christian authors out there who are right about good pride. And you can make a case there is such a thing. I just don't even like the word because I know how prone I am to it. I'd be the one theologizing here. with Aslan at my back, wish I'd shut up. You know, so I know how tempting pride can be. I always know everything about everything, I think, which I really don't. I don't know anything. Get me out of these areas. Yeah, my family are amazed how stupid I am about pop culture, music, sports, politics, about everything else. You know, I'm like Jack. I'm a dinosaur. I belong to a different age. I don't even know what's going on out there. Anyway. So now watch the continued transformation with Erebus. Happy the horse who knows that while he's still young, or the human either. Draw near Erebus, my daughter. Now I need to work on you, Erebus. Draw near Erebus, my daughter. My paws are velveted. You will not be what? Torn this time. This time, sir? I'd be a little nervous if I was her too. Remember, Aslan doing her back. It was I who wounded you, said Aslan. I'm the only lion you met in all your journeyings. Do you know why I tore you? No, sir. The scratches on your back, tear for tear, throb for throb, throb, blood for blood, were equal to the stripes laid on the back of your stepmother's slave because of the drugged sleep you cast upon her. You needed to know what it felt like. Go back in the story. What's he talking about? What did Erebus do? Because the slave was supposed to go with her for 3 days and bring her back. Well, Erebus is like, I'm not coming back. So she drugged the poor slave. You need to know what it felt like. Yes, sir, please. Ask on, my dear, said Aslan. Will any more harm come to her by what I did? Child, said the lion, you know this is coming. I'm telling you your story, not hers. No one has told any story but their own. Then he shook his head and spoke in a lighter voice. Be merry, little ones, he said. We shall meet soon again. But before that, you will have another visitor. Then in one bound, he leaped over the top of the wall and he vanished from their sight. So to build on this, Erebus being hurt, but not harmed by Aslan. The text I want you to, I hope you know this text. It has brought a lot of comfort to me over the years. It's Hebrews chapter 12. People tend to know the beginning of chapter 12 better than they know on into chapter 12. Chapter 12, by the way, I will be teaching Hebrews on Wednesdays. Hebrews is an amazing book. You know, it begins, therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, chapter 12, 1, verse 1. Therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside. We know that, but we skip over the part. Let's start reading at verse 5 of chapter 12 of Hebrews. Because again, he's writing to a church, a group of Christians, probably who came out of Judaism, but because of persecution, they are floating back toward Judaism. Because of the Roman Empire, Judaism was legal, but the new superstition, Christianity, was not. So they could float back to Judaism, float back to the old ways, go back to Kalorman, and be safe. So the book of Hebrews is written to help these people to, you know, hang in there. Stand firm. Anyway, so verse 5, chapter 12, and have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons or children of God? And then he quotes from the book of Proverbs, I'm pretty sure. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him, for the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. Gee, thanks, Father. It is for discipline. Remember what C.S. Lewis calls this? The intolerable compliment. You know, just leave me alone, Father. I'm fine. Don't discipline me. Verse 7, the case he's making here, because you are a child or daughter of the King, he loves you enough to be involved. He pays you the intolerable compliment. He will push and mold and prune you to help you grow up. Verse 7, after he's quoted the Bible, the author of Hebrews goes on to say, it is for discipline that you have to endure. God is treating you as children. For what child is there whom his father does not discipline? If you don't discipline your child, you're not a good parent. You're not a good father. If you try to take away all obstacles from the life of your child, if you want to make sure your child never falls, your child never hurts, your child never gets any boo-boos, you're not a good parent. They have to go through this stuff. Verse 8, if you are left without discipline, watch this. If you're left without discipline, you know, if you're not being disciplined by the Father, in which all have participated, we're participating, you may not know what it is. You might just thought of those other terrible people in your lives. If you're left without discipline, which all have participated, then you are what kind of children? Yeah, I can think of another word he probably used. Okay, if you're an illegitimate child, you know, the Father doesn't worry about you enough to discipline you. But you're real children of the King. Besides this, verse 9, besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time. Still remember those hickory sticks my father sent me out to get. For they disciplined us for a short time, as it seemed best to us. But he, God, disciplines us for our good, that we may share his what? Holiness. No pain, no gain. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. But later, no pain, no gain. I go to the gym. I try to go to the gym 5 out of 7 days. I hate it. I hate it. I've hated it 40 years. I feel like I'm going to the rack to be tortured. But I pay the bill. And I'm too Scottish to not use the money. I pay the bill. I get in the car. I walk in the building. So you look real stupid if you don't do anything when you're in there. I wish. I'm still waiting to get addicted to the dopamine to make me enjoy going to the gym. But, you know, I go in saying, no pain, no gain, no pain, no gain, no pain, no gain. Yeah, it's about our holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. Yeah, I've never found it pleasant in the gym. I don't care what it is. Cardio, weight training, none of it. Now, some people just look like they're having a good time. And they will pay people to help them have a better time in there. And I'm not there yet after 40 years. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. But later, think about the later. But later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Yeah, Aslan's trying to help. Aslan was not harming Erebus. Aslan was disciplining, training, paying her the intolerable compliment, paying enough attention to her to help her get to where she needed to get quickly. Anyway, this is core Christianity, which again, if the church is out there that tell you, you know, being Christian means you're going to be wealthy and prosperous and healthy and happy, you can have your best life now. Yeah, they pack those churches. True Christianity that says, you know, life is like, Book of Hebrews actually uses the image of a gymnasium. God has got you in a gymnasium. So thankfully, pay the bill and be grateful. You know, it's hard, but God, that's why in the Bible, gymnasium, furnace, and forges are three of the images that God uses for life. Now, if you're just into pleasure, you're going to avoid gymnasium, furnaces, and fires. Furnaces and forges. You want to avoid those if you're just into pleasure. But yeah, that's not the biblical faith. That's not really what we're after. Anyway, so let's wrap up. You notice Erebus does apologize. She mentions it, and she does. Because the visitor that is to come is who? Cor, Shasta. Cor shows up. You got a little sketch of him showing up. He looks like a prince. It takes him a little while to realize that's Shasta. But it's Prince Cor. And you notice that Erebus does apologize. All these people are being changed. She actually says, I'm sorry I've been such a pig. That's the way she apologizes. Then Oh, by the way, you notice, then Cor Shasta tells the story. And by the way, just in case you missed it, he mentions education twice. You know, even though education, all sorts of horrible things are going to all sorts of horrible things like education are going to happen. That's an echo. If you read Surprised by Joy, Jack tells more about his horrible, horrible years in what we would call elementary school than he tells you about serving in World War I. He actually calls one of his schools Belson. Now, it's not because he doesn't want to betray the name, the true name of the school. We know which school it was. He gave it the name Belson because Belson was what in World War II in Germany? Concentration camp. So Jack, until he got to his private tutor who prepared him for Oxford, he had a horrible experience in his schools. So, when, you know, and he grew up to be an educator. Don't miss out on that one. But notice he did not have warm, fuzzy feelings about the schools he was sent to. So twice, Corin is like, don't be happy for me. Yes, I'm a child of the king. I'm a prince. But I got to be educated now. They're going to teach me stuff. I think that's an echo of Jack's experience. And then you notice at the end, and this may be the main sentence out of all this book, at the end of Shasta / Cor telling his story, he talks about, you know, you learned about Bar. By the way, Bar, who's the counselor? What's he called? The supreme counselor or something for the king. He's doing something like embezzling. He's embezzling from the king. Bar, you know what the word bar means. When bar is an old term for lawyers. You're admitted to the bar. The group of lawyers is called the bar. Anyway, so Bar, this counselor, who's named Bar, you know, flees. They chase him. They've got the son because there was this prophecy because Bar was under the pay of the Tisroch down in Kalorman. And there was this prophecy from a centaur that that child, Cor, would grow up and one day save Arkanland. So Bar is trying to get away, go back to who's paying him off. Anyway, that's when there's the naval battle and Bar gets killed and, you know, Arkanland people prevail. But that's when Cor / Shasta as a baby gets put in the little boat with a knight who evidently starved himself to death or died of thirst because he was taking care of the baby. That's how he ended up in that little boat that went to where just so happened that Arshish was up in the middle of the night on the shore. And that's who am I talking about here? When Shasta / Cor is telling the story, he says, give you the sentence. But one of his men said that early that morning, as soon as he saw he was certain to be overhauled, Bar had given me to one of his knights and sent us away in the ship's boat. And that boat was never seen again. But of course, that was the same boat that Aslan. And it's a parenthesis here. He seems to be at the back of all our stories. Pushed ashore at the right place for Arshish to pick up. I wish I knew that knight's name, for he must have kept me alive and starved himself to do it. And then Ervis got it at this point. I suppose Aslan would say that's part of someone else's story. Yeah, it was a knight's story. Anyway, so it ends with that amazing picture on the back of the last page of chapter 14. You see Bree having a good role, because he's so concerned. He's going to Narnia. He's got a docktail. He's living as a regular horse in Kalorman. He's enjoyed things like rolling in the grass. But that might not be dignified. That might not suit his vanity. That might not suit his pride. Can he roll around in the grass when he gets to Narnia? They may be higher class up there in Narnia. The horses might be higher class. And of course, I love what Wynn, because we like Wynn. I'm going to roll anyway. I don't suppose any of them, the horses up in Narnia, will care two lumps of sugar whether you roll or not. I like Wynn. We're supposed to like Wynn. Well, that's when Bree gets down and rolls, has a really good roll. But then he gets up and knows the last paragraph as they're making their way to Narnia. But Bree looked more like a horse going to a funeral than a long-lost captive returning to home and freedom. He's not completely cured yet of his pride, his sense of dignity, his vanity. You know, he even made a mark about when he gets back to Narnia, he wants to make a good first impression. None of those things are wrong in the right balance. But as human beings, by nature, we are addictive. As human beings, by nature, we are obsessive. So part of spiritual direction is choose your addictions, choose your obsessions wisely. Don't let it be how you look. Don't let it be how you present. Those are not unimportant things. That should be down the list of what's most important to you in life. I mean, there are people in this culture, in the churches, that spend more time getting their bodies ready in the morning than getting their souls ready to face the day. Just as a thought, you know, make sure you keep the right balance there. You know, you don't need to walk out. I spend some time getting ready. I take a washcloth and rub my head and take a shower. But I don't spend 2 hours getting ready and 5 minutes with the Lord each morning. It's about balance. You know, that's the spiritual life. Because again, one of the things that will get things out of balance so quickly is pride. I know more about football than anybody knows about football. So I'm eating and sleeping and breathing football. And I'm going to football my way all the way out of a marriage. I'm going to football my way out of a spiritual life. I'm going to football my way out. And I'm not against football. It's all about balance. And as human beings, because of our sin nature, we don't do balance well. Go back to the Garden of Eden. Go back. They should have at least asked a few more questions before they ate the fruit. But you know how we are about food. You know, anyway, let's pray together. Next week is an amazing Rabadash. Next week is amazing. What happens to Rabadash? Some great lessons. Let's pray together. God, I'm so grateful for all the ways that you are involved in our lives, for all the ways that we don't even perceive and recognize that you're working in our lives. And for those who are surrendered to you, who seek your will first and foremost in their lives, you have promised that you cause all things to work together for good to those who love you and are the called according to your purpose. So God, we want you to work all things to our good. Therefore, we want to answer the call to live according to your purpose and to love you with our whole heart. God, thank you for the ways that you turn all things to our good, even the painful things. You even take the hard things in life and use them for our training, for our discipline, to help us mature. In the name of Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen. Go forth and tell somebody about Jesus, but tell somebody about the Chronicles of Narnia, too.